Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, welcome to Late Night Cram. I'm Henry Melcher. I'm a supervising producer at the show.
And I'm Sal Gentile. I'm the Closer Look supervising writer.
On this episode, we talk to Washington Post op-ed columnist Catherine Rampell about the state of the economy.
As Trump faces an intensifying impeachment inquiry, he's very likely to become the third president in history to be impeached. Yesterday, the House voted on this resolution setting out the next stage of the impeachment process. The one thing he thinks insulates him from political consequences, from political peril, the thing he talks about the most is the economy. And so we want to ask Catherine whether that's actually true, what the current state of the economy is, and how Trump has, in many cases, made it worse.
And as Catherine explains, Trump does not always know what he is doing.
Might come as a shock to you, listener.
Yeah, listener, you might be surprised that Donald Trump does not always make the best decisions and have a full, competent understanding of the economy and the best moves to improve the economy.
Mm-hmm. He has virtually no understanding of many of the basic things involved in a lot of his policies, whether it's trade policies, as Catherine will explain. And she's really great at explaining a lot of complicated stuff. You know, for example, something like the inverted yield curve.
Which is something that we personally knew a lot about.
We're both experts on. We know exactly what a yield curve is.
If you're wondering about the yield curve and its inversion.
It'll be helpful for you. We know what a yield curve is.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it was kind of boring, actually.
Yeah, like, yeah. We're super in-depth experts on the yield curve.
We've written so many papers about it.
It would be passé for us to even explain right now what we think the yield curve is and what an inverted yield curve is and why that's such a big deal. You know?
I mean, it is a big deal.
It is. And it is believe me, yes, it absolutely is. And we fully understand why it's a big deal. Just to be clear, Henry and I don't know what an inverted yield curve is.
We have no idea what it is.
We have no idea what an inverted yield curve is.
Catherine explained it to us, which was very helpful. But if I were to now have to explain it back to someone, I feel like I'd be 70% of the way there.
Yes.
And that might be generous.
Yes. It's best to listen to the expert, Catherine, explain it. She's really great at it.
It was a really fun conversation. It's some very wonky policy talk, but it is super interesting. And she was just such a great guest. So without any further ado, here is Catherine. We are here with Catherine Rampell, an op-ed columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
We want to talk to you about the state of the economy. And today we got the jobs numbers. And the jobs numbers were 128,000 new jobs created. That was more than, I think, some of the predictions.
Yes.
I am not an expert on this matter at all. Neither is the president. I thought we could maybe start by just
understatement,
reading.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. I thought we could maybe start by reading the president's tweet about these jobs numbers. And you could tell us if he got the numbers right.
Okay.
So he tweeted after 128,000
jobs. I'm really
jobs.
In suspense. I'm in suspense.
I know, it
could
go
numbers,
either way.
Right?
Yeah.
It really
could.
Here we go. Yeah. All right. He tweeted, wow, a blowout all caps jobs number just out. Adjusted for revisions and the General Motors strike, 303,000. This is far greater than expectations. All caps, USA rocks. So is his math?
No.
Okay. There it is.
No, in short. No, look, the jobs numbers.
But you can't disagree that USA rocks.
No,
caps?
No, I do agree
disagree.
With that. That's,
we all agree
that's true.
USA rocks.
That's true. Yeah. There is one very narrow area of common views between me and Trump, and maybe that's
all
part
caps,
of it.
USA
yeah,
rocks.
All caps USA rocks. Look, the jobs numbers were actually better than expected. Mm-hmm. They were pretty good today. You know, they're not great. The trend this year is still below what it was last year, below what it was under Obama, but we're not like on the verge of recession, as it looked like we might be a few months ago. So in general, the numbers are pretty good, which makes it weird that Trump decided to like gild the lily here, yeah. right? And like more than double what they actually are. So what he's saying in that tweet, I think, based on people who have reached out to his Council of Economic Advisors who were like, where did this come from?
Because they've got to now answer.
Yes. Well, I think they're the ones. Yeah. Well, I don't know if they produced it and then he tweeted it or he tweeted it and then they like sort of had to backfill a bunch of assumptions because that's what they've done on other things, right. by the way.
Yeah.
So in this case, it looks like what he's doing is he's saying not just the number for October, which, as I said, was pretty good relative to expectations, but also adding in the GM workers who were on strike. Okay, maybe that's okay. That's like a little bit fair. They're back to work now. Also adding in the revisions from previous months, which were good, but that's not really how you do this math normally. Mm-hmm. And then also adding in, it's not in the tweet, but according to the Council of Economic Advisors, adding in census workers. So there were a bunch of census workers who were temporarily hired because next year we have, as the Constitution requires, decennial census, and they completed their jobs. So their jobs ended, and that subtracted from the total numbers. But so he's saying, like, that doesn't count because those jobs disappeared, but they kind of weren't real to begin with. But somehow he thought they were real when they were added, right?
Right?
So, like, census jobs only count when they're positive, not when they're negative. Mm. So, anyway, this is just, like, a very elaborate in-the-weeds mm-hmm. way of saying he's cooking the books,
right.
which is
yeah.
what he does with a lot of things.
Plus, if you count all the lawyers that White House aides have had to hire, like, that's another, like, 1,000 jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah. The legal sector saw a huge
spike.
Yeah,
legal sector's
killing. Yeah, I don't know if that should count or not,
yeah, right?
Because, like, those are maybe only temporary jobs.
That's right. Seasonal jobs.
right. I don't know how you adjust
for crime
for all
season,
that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. As Trump faces impeachment, I think he thinks, obviously he said this pretty much explicitly, and a lot of his allies have said, that the economy insulates him politically. It seems like the case might be a little more mixed. I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit.
Sure. So I think the first thing I would say is if you commit high crimes and misdemeanors, like low unemployment doesn't cancel that out. That's
yes.
not a provision of the Constitution. The
yes.
founding fathers did not say, like, you can commit treason except
right.
if unemployment is really low.
We actually made this point in a closer look yesterday. There's no footnote in the Constitution
yes.
that says, like, unless the stock market's good, then in
yes.
which case, stop with this impeachment stuff. Yeah.
Yes. So let's just put that out there. But the second issue, of course, is that even if you thought, well, maybe the politics are different, maybe like the founding fathers weren't saying treason doesn't count if X, Y, and Z, but like maybe there won't be the political will to hold a president accountable under the current circumstances, it's not totally clear that that's true. Yes, the economy has been kind of the only thing that Trump has going for him, right? The unemployment is very low. We are not in recession. In fact, we are now in the longest recovery on record, a recovery, of course, that began under Obama.
And as you mentioned, I think very important to point, the trend is actually lower. The jobs trend is actually
yes.
lower than it was under
yes.
Obama.
I mean,
but then again, USA rocks.
Yeah,
USA
right.
rocks.
Let's remember
so,
the USA
right,
rocks.
Right. So, you know, the numbers have not been great. They're not bad. I don't
yeah.
want to suggest that they're bad, but they have not been great, particularly in the context of all of the fiscal stimulus that we have been pumping into the economy. We had this major tax cut. Spending has gone up. Under those circumstances, you would expect generally a nice sugar high at the very least to continue through this year, maybe through next year. And instead, we're seeing the opposite. So we just had GDP numbers come out this week showing an annualized rate of 1.9% growth. That would be, look, totally respectable if we hadn't done all of this stuff. That is what the Fed and others think the long-term growth rate for the economy should be. But given how much fiscal stimulus there has been, and of course, given what Trump has claimed about this being the greatest economy ever, which I think was also an all-caps tweet. Maybe
yeah.
it was not all-caps. Maybe it was partially capitalized. I don't remember.
He does that a lot.
He does it a lot, right.
Yeah,
yeah.
The
I'm sure
case is hard
right.
to track.
Fair enough. You know, given all of that, we are certainly not on track for the kinds of economic growth promises that Trump made during both the campaign and as president, right? He said we were going to get 3% growth, 4% growth, 6% growth.
Right.
And we are not seeing any of that, mm-hmm. despite the fact that, you know, they're sort of cheating a little bit by, again, having fiscal stimulus at a time when the economy arguably does not need it. So given all of that, the track record is not great. And in fact, the way that the tax cuts were supposed to, like, turbocharge the economy was by turbocharging business investment, right? He said that this is going to, I don't know that he actually articulated this, but his economists or people pretending to be economists in some cases said this. But basically they said that, like, look, companies are just going to invest so much more, and that's going to, like,
juice. Right, this was the logic.
Yeah. Right, that was going to juice the economy. And instead, what we saw in the last two quarters, business investment actually shrank. Hmm. So we've had the opposite result of what had been predicted, which, you know, suggests some combination of the tax cuts are underperforming, and also Trump's trade wars have, like, royally screwed up the economy as well. Right. So the combination of all of these things on his economic agenda just have not produced the results that... that he had promised.
And the other thing you've written about is that the deficit is just, like, skyrocketed under Trump. It's at $1 trillion. And I didn't realize you pointed this out in one of your op-eds that he'd promised just to eliminate the debt.
Oh, yeah.
Was it $23 trillion, the U.S. debt? And he was just like, he'll get rid of it. How BS has he been on the deficit and debt, which Republicans have a long track record of criticizing under Democrats, and then they don't care when they're in power?
Yes. So Trump made this promise during the campaign that he was going to eliminate the debt, which was always...
The king of debt.
Oh, yeah.
Right, the king of debt, right. Yeah. Well, he sort of claimed that was an advantage, right? He's like, I know a lot about debt. I can negotiate it down. It's always not how it works.
It reminds me of when he did that Stephanopoulos interview and he talked about prosecutors and he's like, I know more about prosecutors than anybody. It's like, that doesn't sound the way you think it sounds. Yeah.
Well, in the case of what he was claiming about negotiating down our debt, this is a little bit of a tangent, but basically that would have caused a worldwide financial crisis. So, because that's the same thing as saying we're going to default.
So bad. So
yes,
bad is what you're
bad,
saying.
Yeah.
All caps bad.
All caps bad. Or selectively capitalized bad, either
way.
Right.
Weird exclamation points.
Right. So, he's done the opposite, right? Even reducing the debt would mean that we would not have deficits at all, right? A deficit is how much we spend more than we take in a given year, and then the debt is like the accumulation of all of those deficits.
Which he has not shown that he even knows the difference.
No, of course not.
He probably truly does not know the difference between those things.
No. And then he doesn't know the words to God Bless America, so I don't know that he necessarily...
A lot of Americans don't know the words to God Bless America.
Fair. But yeah. I think it's fair to assume he doesn't know the difference between the debt and the deficit.
But in any case, you would expect to see us paying down, like taking in more money than we spend, paying down that debt through budget surpluses rather than deficits. And instead, we've done the opposite. We had, as you just mentioned, basically a $1 trillion deficit this past year, which sounds like a big number, and it is. And part of why it's significant is that, A, you know, the tax cuts aren't paying for themselves. That's part of it. But also, like, normally when the economy is doing well, as I just mentioned, we are in the longest expansion on record at this point. When the economy...
USA rocks.
When the economy is doing well, that's normally when deficits shrink or even become surpluses. And the reason for that is twofold. One is that when the economy is good, people don't need food stamps as often. They don't need unemployment insurance. They maybe don't need Medicaid, things like that. Also, when the economy is good, people and companies make more money, so they pay more in taxes. Mm-hmm. And instead, and this has been the trend, by the way, basically since World War II, that if you, like, look at a chart of unemployment versus deficits, they kind of, like, move in tandem. Instead, over the last few years, they have decoupled. And that suggests that there is no, like, good economy around the corner that's going to solve this debt and deficit problem for us. Instead, we're just continuing to spend a lot more than we tax. And maybe that matters and maybe it doesn't matter. There's like a big debate right now amongst economists about how much deficits actually matter. But certainly Republicans have claimed for years, especially under Obama, when we were facing a possible Great Depression, that there should be no tolerance of big deficits and that they were going to be the party of fiscal responsibility. And that's why, they basically tried to block all of the stimulus measures that Obama oversaw. And instead, they're stimulating the economy now when we don't need it. Deficits are going up when historically they wouldn't be.
Yeah. As you mentioned, on the merits, as you say, there's this debate over how much deficits matter at all. But politically, I hope we at least have the institutional memory now to take into account that Republicans obviously never cared about deficits, and they just use it as a cudgel against things they don't like. It's just a substitute for, I don't like that thing. If I don't like that thing, I'll say that's bad for the deficit. And then when you're in power, if you like that thing, you don't care whether it explodes.
Like the Tea Party grew out of this.
Yes. And or supposedly. In reality, it was not about the deficit, but they claimed it was just a fake sort of cudgel to use against things that they did not like.
Right, and you're even seeing that continue to happen now by Republicans who, again, have overseen, even when they had unified control of government, right, when Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency, they had they passed tax cuts and spending increases. Even today, they're still saying, like, oh, deficits are so bad. The thing we need to do is cut Medicare, right?
Right.
But also we need to cut taxes, too.
Right.
Not
that's
kind
the
of,
two-step. A $1 trillion tax cut, and then, oh, now the deficit's exploding. We have to cut programs that vulnerable people rely on.
Right, right.
Well, I mean, a few months ago, we talked to an Axios reporter about how difficult it was covering the Obamacare repeal efforts of a couple years ago because none of it was done in good faith. How was it covering the tax cut package as an economics reporter? Because also none of that was done in good faith. None of the math added up. None of their arguments made sense.
They were literally scribbling in the margins.
Yeah.
Well, what was interesting was that the only thing that you can basically argue Republicans stand for right now is tax cuts. Like, there are no other principles as far as I can identify. You know, maybe there were at some point, but right now that's the only thing that they agree on. You know, it's not small government or whatever other fiscal things. Like, it's not really clear where they stand on a lot of social issues, et cetera. But anyway, where I was going with this was that when they were trying to come up with ways to defend their tax cut back in 2017, what was interesting was that they seemed to think this was a great plan, a brilliant plan, the only thing really that the Republicans should stand for, and yet they would not defend it on the merits, right? If it was really such a great idea, why did they pretend that it was targeting the middle class,
right?
If it was such a great idea, why did they pretend that it was going to pay for itself? You know, why not say, like, we don't think it's going to pay for itself, but we think it's worth it because of reasons X, Y, and Z. Or we love the middle class, but we just don't think that that's, like, the most important constituency here. Why lie about the numbers? Why lie about who it was going to help? Why lie about the fact that Trump kept claiming that it was going to raise his taxes, which, of course, we still haven't seen his tax returns.
Right.
But, it beggars belief that that anything.
He's also repeatedly said he's lost billions of dollars as president. That
as a sacrifice
has
to
cost
us
him
to
literally
help.
With a B, he has said billions of dollars, which is, you know.
Well, I'd love to see his tax returns so we could fact check those claims.
Yes, right.
But in any case, you know, again, if these were good policies, why not defend them on their own terms?
Totally.
Why, like, mischaracterize what they actually do?
Yeah. I wanted to ask because one of the things that Democrats push back on Trump's narrative of the economy, you know, he talks about the stock market, unemployment, these jobs numbers. But Democrats point out that wage growth has been fairly slow. It's improving, but it's not improving kind of in tandem with the rest of the economy. What is the current state of wage growth? And how do you, I mean, what are the tools to stimulate that?
We don't really have great, finely grained tools to deal with this. I think the numbers today from the jobs report were something like 3% year over year around there in nominal growth. So before, that means it's just before inflation, which is fine. It's not great. It's fine. You know, one thing that the Trump administration has boasted about that actually is that has for the last few months or so been true is that less educated people have been seeing faster wage growth than more educated people. Whether or not Trump should get credit for that is a separate question. As I said, we're very late into this recovery, into this economic expansion, and historically speaking, the more educated people get the wage gains first, and then it sort of moves down the, you know, education or skill ladder.
So the recovery that started under Obama is basically following the pattern you'd expect.
Right. And again, whether or not Trump should get credit for this or whether or not Obama should get credit for any of this is a difficult question. I think in general, presidents get too much credit when things are good and too much blame when things are bad. So I don't want to suggest that either one of these leaders should get full responsibility for any given economic metric. But that said, the thing that you would expect to lead to higher wage growth is just the job market getting tighter, the term for it, meaning that unemployment is low, in order for firms to continue to get workers or to continue to hold on to the existing employees that they have, they're going to have to offer them more money just because there aren't that many people sitting on the sidelines or people looking for jobs. There are fewer workers available, so you got to pay the ones who are available a little bit more. Right. But that phenomenon, which you would have expected to happen, we thought was going to happen several years ago, and it kind of didn't. And it's a little bit of a puzzle in the economy right now why there hasn't been more wage growth. There are lots of different plausible explanations. Maybe just labor in general has less bargaining power than it used to, right? Because there are fewer protections
decline
for
of unions,
decline
yeah.
of unions, et cetera. It could have something weird to do with the composition of the workforce, that maybe there are more younger workers today. The older workers are retiring. Older workers tend, because they're later in their career, they tend to make more money. So, like, maybe it's just you're sort of changing the composition of people, so the people who are getting jobs are going to be paid at lower levels, and it looks like, I don't know. So there are a lot of possible explanations, but we don't really know.
And this loops back, I think, to what you said about the tax cut, which is that even that one thing, that one metric that you could say was the good faith argument, if you put aside, like, yes, it's tilted to, massively tilted toward the wealthy and corporations, yes, it's not going to pay for itself, but it's going to shake loose some business investment, and that's going to produce wage growth and all this stuff. Even that has not happened.
No, it has not happened. Instead, what has happened is that companies have basically, have used the tax cuts, the cash windfall that they effectively got, and just returned the money to their shareholders, which implies that it's not that they're evil, it's just that they don't see a productive use for where to invest that money. So instead, it makes sense for them to just return it to shareholders, either through stock buybacks or through dividend payments.
And maybe Republicans, the people who were pushing for this, knew that that was likely to happen,
right.
And they just lied about what they thought
The argument that the real thing that was holding back our economy was that there wasn't enough access to capital was always a little bit, in my view, tenuous, because interest rates were really low. Companies were sitting on a lot of cash. It's not like Apple would have invested in whatever the next iPhone is, except that they couldn't access capital. They clearly had a lot of capital.
It is funny to imagine Apple being like, look, we'd love to make a new iPhone, but we can't. We don't have enough money.
I wish.
Isn't it the case that they were sitting on, like, the largest cash hoard at one point in, like, history, recorded history?
That may be the case. I don't know. And look,
I'm just going to say it and put USA Rocks at the end of it.
Fair enough. Look, it may be the case that in the long run, some of these changes to the corporate tax code will be good for the economy. But will the amount of growth that they add to the economy outweigh the amount of cost we are incurring as a result of these $2 trillion tax cuts? Basically, no independent outside forecaster says that to be the case. And again, the Trump administration, Republicans on the Hill, could have argued, well, you know what? That's a trade-off we're willing to take. We are going to do this. We know it's going to cause a big fiscal hole, but we think that's the right thing to do for moral reasons or otherwise. And we will offset it by making painful decisions about defense spending or something. They could have said that, but they didn't say that. What they said was, la, 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 it's going to pay for itself, no pain whatsoever. We're still the party of fiscal responsibility.
And you talked about the moral choices of the tax cut plan. I remember, and it's what everyone predicted, or at least on the left predicted, that after they passed that, then instantly the Republicans started saying, well, now we really should start cutting the social safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be the way to pay for it, that they weren't running on in the kind of lead up to the bill.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
We are here with Catherine Rampell, and I'm curious to ask you about this idea of will there be a recession or won't there? For the past 2 years, it has been kind of head spinning as someone who does not fully understand the intricacies of the economy, and we're just watching cable news and reading articles and listening to podcasts about the economy. I mean, as an economic reporter, how difficult is it to track or predict if there will be a recession? And just do your friends and family constantly call you and they're like, is it good news or is it bad news? Please tell me, should I be scared or should I be buying a lot of things?
And also separately, in my 401k?
And also separately, I'd like to ask, is it good news or is it bad news? And should I start selling everything in my 401k?
If I could accurately predict a recession, I would be a much richer woman. Nobody can really do that. Even the official team of economists from the National Bureau of Economic Research that decides whether a recession has occurred or whether, if you're in a recession, whether an expansion has occurred, they can't tell in the moment. They generally say retrospectively, like, we think a year ago is when the economy actually turned. So what they do is they look at all of the data and they say it looks as if a lot of things were kind of moving in sync, either up or down, and that was a switch, and therefore the economy turned. So it's very hard to tell in real time. The best you can do is to say, look, there are a number of indicators that seem kind of bad right now. For example, if I were a glass half empty kind of person, I would say manufacturing numbers suggest that manufacturing is in recession. I might point out that farm bankruptcies are up like 25%. Over the previous year. I might point out that, you know, we've seen job losses in retail and a bunch of other sectors, things like that.
So just as a sidebar, not to interrupt you, but you mentioned the manufacturing recession, which has been noted, and that's a whole other thing, which Trump had promised to magically revive manufacturing.
There was going to be a renaissance.
And now, yes, right. And now it very much looks like manufacturing is in recession, which is yet another thing that he just sort of mindlessly promised and is not true. But anyway,
right.
Yes.
So, and manufacturing, by the way, manufacturing has been sort of, at least in terms of jobs, if not actual economic activity, has been shrinking, broadly speaking, like over the last several decades. Right. So that predates Trump, and the idea that he was suddenly going to be able to turn things around and we were going to go back to the share of the U.S. employment that's in manufacturing that it was in like the 70s or something was always a fantasy.
Right.
But that said, a number of his policies have actually made things worse, including the trade war, right?
Yeah, yeah. If
by putting new tariffs on inputs that U.S. manufacturing companies buy, steel and aluminum, for example, that makes their business model much more expensive. It makes their business model much more uncertain. And of course, there have been retaliatory tariffs. So, and even the steel industry is not doing well. They were supposed to be helped by all of this, but that's an aside. So in any case, there are a number of reasons to say that, look, there are things that look bad. The indicator that got a lot of attention, I want to say this summer, was this thing called the yield curve. Treasury yield curve, which
now Henry and I both intimately understand the yield curve, and we know how it works. And every time we hear the phrase, we definitely know what it means.
Yeah,
and an inverted yield curve. When we heard that, we were both alarmed.
Like that's
we,
so
we
obvious.
We know what the invert. We know we're like, oh my god, the yield curve's inverted. We
again?
Know
again.
Yeah.
So then,
oh
you know,
my god.
I
and
mean,
then we both were like,
the percentages.
Yeah,
were...
we were having very detailed, in-depth discussions about what it means, and so we just,
so we
you know,
just
but
skip
rather
this.
Than have us, yeah, you know, rather, but you know, we know too much about it, so if you could maybe just
you want to test me.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
You could just briefly explain
what
the inverted yield curve means. Yeah, because again, I don't want to go
I mean,
on
honestly,
this crazy.
I spent so much time in grad school talking about
yes.
it. I'm so bored of it.
Yes,
by
right.
now.
I mean, I've written my whole thesis was about the inverted yield curve.
I was a student
curve.
I was brought on to be a TA just
yeah,
because
people are always
I
just
asking
on the yield
me.
Curve.
Yeah.
Just on the yield curve.
Very
I didn't
impressive.
Understand the rest of the class, but the
parents
yield curve
are always
is easy.
Asking me to sit down and tutor their kids on the yield curve. And I'm like, I don't. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Anyway,
so how do you understand
yeah, how do you?
Well,
what would you say about what the yield curve is?
This is a pop quiz for me. I understand. You're trying to test my knowledge. Basically, this is the idea that the U.S. Treasury loans out money,
right?
Right?
Yeah,
we, like
exactly.
You and I can buy bonds from Treasury. We are lending to Treasury, and they have bonds available at different what's called maturity dates. Right? You can buy a bond that matures in 3 months or one that matures in 10 years. And normally, when the economy looks healthy, when you are lending to the U.S. government for longer periods of time, you get a higher interest rate because, like, that money's tied up for longer. You're maybe taking on more risk. So If you buy a 10-year treasury, that's going to, you know, I'm just making up numbers, but like you might expect a 4% interest rate, and a 3-month treasury, you might expect like a 1% interest rate. I'm just making up these numbers, but you get the idea that like usually the longer the debt is.
As far as I'm aware now, making up numbers is totally fine, okay. By the way.
It doesn't literally, yeah.
As we established at the top, like
with the president, you're in good company with the president.
Yeah, you can pretty much say whatever you want.
And so when the economy is healthy, that's kind of what it looks like. It's like the longer maturity the debt is, the higher the interest rate is. And that's the yield curve, the different levels of interest rates along those different maturity dates. And when the economy doesn't look so good, potentially, what might happen is people start expecting that the Fed is going to cut rates. And so that will lead to longer term debt paying a lower interest rate than shorter term debt. Mm-hmm. So it's just that's what the inversion is.
But
it's like the numbers get flipped. So the bottom line is that historically, when you've seen this kind of inversion of the yield curve, it has preceded a recession.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean a recession has to come, but it had. You've seen a correlation between those two things. So when we had this inversion of the yield curve, there was a lot of concern that that meant recession was nigh, and it has sort of uninverted. So the thing that people were like so exercised about that they thought meant, independent of whatever was happening with job growth and manufacturing numbers and whatever else, what they thought was like the really bad sign, the red flashing light, was this yield curve. And so that's why there was a lot of panic about an imminent recession, and things seem to have calmed down a little bit. As I said, the numbers are still not great, particularly in the context of a lot of the policy choices that we've made. But
well, I don't even know if you can call this a policy choice, but we've talked about the trade war a few times. How head-spinning was that for you to see? Because it just seems like it was a one-shot way just to screw up the economy in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's been interesting for a number of reasons, in part because Republicans have historically considered themselves the party of free trade, of course. And as I said, the only principle they stand for now is tax cuts, although technically speaking, tariffs are taxes. So Trump has actually raised taxes.
So even there, it's like, not
consistent. We're at zero.
Now we're at zero in terms of principles.
And Democrats have been more anti trade historically. When they get into the White House, it changes a little bit. Obama was relatively anti-trade before he got into the White House, and then his administration was relatively pro-trade. That's an evolution you see kind of not just specific to Obama, but a little bit across the board. So, but either way, the change in policy position amongst the general Republican Party was jarring. And also the fact that we have so much evidence that raising barriers to trade is not going to actually create this manufacturing renaissance that Trump promised. There was this question about why did Trump think that this time was going to be different? I guess it's that he's not exactly a student of history and didn't pay attention to previous periods where we raised tariffs and then predictably saw retaliation from other countries, and then you had these wars going on. This happened during the Great Depression, for example. But seeing Republicans kind of twist themselves into knots trying to defend the president's policy has been striking. And it's also been striking that Trump has continued doubling down on this bad strategy. Like I said, maybe he's not a student of history. Maybe he's not aware of the Smoot-Hawley.
Maybe it's charitable.
Remove the maybe.
Yeah.
What are we doing with
the maybe
this
maybe? Is charitable.
Get the maybe out of here.
But
we're going to edit out the maybe.
You know, maybe he thought, like, maybe the reason why we haven't had trade wars before is because nobody thought to do it. You know, maybe he actually thought that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's possible.
But now he thought, and so it was an untested idea, right?
Yeah.
Just like negotiating down the debt and potentially causing a worldwide financial crisis, as I mentioned. Untested idea, maybe he's brilliant, maybe that's what he thought, but now we actually have a track record here, and we see that, for example, with China, we have levied round after round after round of new tariffs on China. All of the research from actually credentialed economists has found that those tariffs are being paid by Americans. They're not being paid by China, so we are basically shooting ourselves in the foot. Also, China's retaliating, and now they're not buying our soybeans and pork and whatever else, and that's hurting our farmers. That's part of the reason why you've seen this rise in farmer bankruptcies that I mentioned before. And yet he's still doubling down.
Right.
He's just is unable to learn. And again, Republicans continue to defend him.
Well, you mentioned
that's
Democrats.
A blanket statement for this era.
Right. Yes. Very true. But you mentioned Democrats. Even if you were, Democrats like Sherrod Brown have made this case. Even if you were skeptical of free trade, or you thought there were some restrictions that were necessary, or there is some reorganization of the relationship that's necessary with China, for example. He's doing it in this both ham-fisted way and also lying about it. For
yes.
example, as you say, lying about the fact that tariffs are actually paid for by American consumers, that it's a tax on American consumers. He doesn't even really seem to understand what a trade deficit is.
He seems to think that if we have a trade deficit with China of, I think the number he uses is $500 billion or something. It's wrong, whatever it is. But that if we have a trade deficit of $500 billion, we are just sending China $500 billion and getting nothing in return.
Right.
That is not, in fact, how it works. We are getting stuff from China, and we are sending them money. And, in fact, they are buying our debt with that money. So to bring things full circle,
right.
that's part of the way we've been financing mm-hmm. things like major tax cuts is that other countries are lending us money. And that's all enabled by these deficits. In any case, he doesn't seem to understand that we are getting something in return. It's like saying I have a deficit with my dentist because I send my dentist money for when I go to the dentist and I get nothing in return. No, or with my grocery store, right? I will point out, by the way, on the China stuff, China has been a bad actor mm-hmm. on
yeah.
trade.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to suggest otherwise. They are stealing our intellectual property. For a while, they were manipulating their currency to make their goods seem cheaper. They actually have not been doing that. That's a very dated talking point at this time. They have not been doing that for several years. But they have been bad actors on trade. They have huge subsidies for state-owned enterprises and things like that. But none of the things that Trump is actually doing as part of his getting tough on China strategy are helping deal with any of that. In fact, arguably the thing that would have been most useful in terms of getting China to behave would have been banding together with all of the other countries that were similarly victimized by China. I'm thinking like Japan and Canada and various other Pacific Rim countries. And the reason I'm mentioning Pacific Rim countries is because this is exactly what Obama did. Mm-hmm. We had a trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Part of the goal of this coalition of the willing was to have like an alliance of countries that wanted to set the rules for trade and keep China out of that deal, but give them incentives to sort of start behaving so that they could get access to those markets on the same favorable terms. And in fact, one of the first things Trump did was to pull us out of that deal. Also interesting because, as I said, Democrats have gotten more pro-trade as they got into office. In the case of TPP, Obama oversaw the negotiation of TPP, but Democrats in general were not in favor of it, yeah. and Republicans were.
And again, there are Democrats who were skeptical of the trade deal that Obama negotiated, and obviously Bernie Sanders ran on that in the 2016 yeah. primary. There are lots of Sherrod Brown, of lots of people who are
like hand and hawed over it for a while, then yeah. ultimately said she rejected it. Is that right?
Right? Yeah.
She supported it as Secretary of State, and then
correct.
Right. And there are Democrats now who say, look, there's a way to reorganize our relationship. It's just that Trump is both lying about it and making it worse.
What's been so fundamentally clear from this conversation is he has no idea what the hell he's doing.
Yeah.
And the whole premise of his presidency was that he was a businessman and knows how to make deals and knows how the economy works. Obviously, that was farcical on its face from the beginning. Everything just keeps cycling back to he doesn't know what he's doing. He's stubborn. He doesn't learn. And he doesn't want to work with other people.
Well, and I think the other problem is that whatever lessons he learned from being a quote-unquote successful businessman.
Yeah.
quote-unquote is doing a lot of work there, yeah.
actually might have the opposite effect when you are trying to negotiate deals as president.
Right. And King of debt.
King of debt. But what
the U.S. is not a USA rocks, but it's not a business.
Yeah. Right. And in particular, the thing that I'm thinking of is that when he was making deals, when he was just like this tough negotiator, a lot of those deals just involved reneging on whatever terms he agreed to. And he would sign a contract saying, I'm going to pay for, you know, 10,000 new granite countertops in my new whatever development, and then refuse to pay for them after they had already been delivered, and be like, psych, see ya, too bad. And then there would always be another granite countertop salesman to do a deal with next time who maybe hadn't heard about the fact that you couldn't actually trust Trump to keep his word. And that worked for him, right? Like, he would just, his deal making just meant he wouldn't honor the deals. But in an international arena, there's a finite number of people to negotiate with. Like, there isn't an infinite number of countries. Like, there might be maybe not an infinite number of granite countertop salesmen, but like a very large supply. Maybe they don't talk to each other. I don't know. But in the case of countries, if in fact we tear up an agreement, for example, we have this new NAFTA deal that Trump signed with Mexico and Canada. Was that last year? I think it was
last year.
And just a few months afterward, after we came to this agreement, which hasn't passed through Capitol Hill yet, which it will need to, but in any case, it was supposed to be in good faith. A few months after that, Trump announced that he was going to have new tariffs on Mexico because he was, like, pissed about how many people were crossing the southern border. So why would you ever negotiate in good faith with this guy if you don't expect him to keep his word? And again, I think this is a lesson that he learned through his business that actually has the opposite effect.
A lesson that trickles down even into political negotiations, like with domestic political negotiations. It's like you negotiate with him once, and then if you have a meeting with Trump, you might come out of that meeting think, oh, we agreed on something. And then somebody will whisper in his ear, and 5 minutes later, he'll tweet something that's the exact opposite to what you thought you were. And eventually, it just gets to the point where everyone realizes, oh, it doesn't matter what this guy says to you in a meeting and what you think you've shaken hands on. When you leave the meeting, it's almost certain that, like, 5 minutes later, a day later, whenever, he'll change his mind and do a complete 180.
Again.
Yes. Right, right. And like I said, there's a finite number of countries
we can negotiate with.
Yeah. There's a finite number of, like, speakers of the House. There's one at any given time. So if he reneges on a deal, as he, apparently he has done multiple times on DACA, for example, amongst other policy issues, if he
reneged on things he said in televised meetings. The immigration gun control, he said
control,
in a televised meeting with Democrats, oh, great, let's do this. Let's do it. And then somebody calls him up and whispers in his ear and just changes his mind.
You also mentioned granite countertops at a Trump building. You just know it was an insane amount of granite, too.
You
know,
like
the everything in the apartment was granite. Crap granite from the beginning. But it was just like every single thing
the
was granite.
The beds are granite.
The toilets.
Dipped in gold.
Granite dipped in gold.
But it's like fake gold, too. It's that gold that peels off. Catherine, thank you so much for chatting with us. This is so interesting, and it's so helpful to talk about the economy with someone who actually understands the economy. It's an incredibly difficult subject to get your head around, and then the president just tweets BS about it all the time, so he muddies the waters even more. So we really appreciate you walking us through how bad he is at the economy.
Thank you, and thank you for your offer to give me personal financial advice.
I will follow up with you. Do not recommend email and phone number to make sure
our listeners have that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.